My name is Daniel, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Scott M. will read the preamble.
Hi, everyone. My name is Scott. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Connie will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Connie, and I'm an alcoholic. Steps. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will and for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you.
Julie N. will read the traditions.
My name is Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Tradition 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself, in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Tradition 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Tradition 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Tradition 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Tradition 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Tradition 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Tradition 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Tradition 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Tradition 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Tradition 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is anniversary night, and we will continue the tradition speaker test format for an additional 1 month. The format of this meeting will be the 10-minute speaker will speak on the sixth tradition, our information break, the main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, and followed by our anniversary celebrants. Tonight, our 10-minute speaker is Peggy B.
Good evening. My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. And our sixth tradition is an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. So let me start off by telling you, sometime in my first 6 months of sobriety, a bunch of us from Midtown, newcomers, all of us under probably, you know, a year, marched over to General Service, which used to be on 33rd and Park Avenue South, and we said, what can we do? You know, we thought they were going to let us in and practically run the office. And they said, well, you know, we're getting ready to hire an archivist, so you can make labels for letters. So we didn't know what that meant. I actually got to read snippets of letters from all over the country. These were objections mailed into the General Service Office. By the way, the General Service Office was not called that in the beginning. It was called the Foundation. Anyway, they were, and that was addressed that way. Foundation, AA, and complaining, you know, and things like a Southern group objecting to non-white members. Another group saying, we should not have women at AA meetings. Marriages will be disrupted. Another one saying, Bill, what do we do? They want to sell the memberships. So what is the genesis of our sixth tradition? You know, I mean, why do we need the tradition? How do we stay to our primary purpose? You know, all this correspondence was sent to the foundation, and it was all answered by Bill and his secretary. Amazing. So in the beginning, in the foundation, they were chartered to lobby for anything except they decided they wouldn't lobby for prohibition. But they lobbied. I mean, they thought, well, the hospitals don't work for alcoholics. I mean, they're throwing them into drunk tanks. Let's build hospitals. They thought that if they had the money, they could do anything. They said, you know, the public doesn't understand us. Let's educate them. Let's rewrite medical books. Now, I must tell you that they set out to do all of that. They also wanted to get into dope addiction, criminality. They wanted to form groups about depressive and paranoid folks. Wow. Gee, do we have any of those? No. They thought if alcoholism could be licked, anything could. So they tried hospitals, failed miserably, tried education, and confused everyone. And one of the best things was that an AA was hired by a liquor trade organization. They wanted a spokesman, and they thought, well, we'll have a sober alcoholic. What a great spokesman. And he came to New York and said, to the board, Bill, and what do you think of this? And they said, we don't think it's a good idea. We don't think it's a good idea. However, which I thought this caveat was very interesting, reading the history, we can't tell you not to take that job. But, you know, he didn't take the job. So today we know the paradox. The more we stick to our primary purpose, the greater our influence. Now, there was a gentleman that came when all of this was happening, and Bill really was in a quandary. What do we do with all of these complaints and all these letters? So a gentleman came to visit Bill and said, Bill, you know, the Washingtonians, did you ever hear of the Washingtonians? And Bill said, no. Called Bob, Dr. Bob Smith. Dr. Bob said, no, I never heard of it. So I'm going to tell you, for those that don't know. April 2nd, 1840, six guys that met every day at Chase's Tavern in downtown Baltimore. On April 2nd, one of them, Bill McCuddy, I think, said, you know what? I think we better stop drinking. And I think we can do it. What we'll do is every day we'll meet and we'll talk about our drinking experience. And we'll talk about how we can stop and we'll help each other. And then we'll ask for divine guidance. So, wow, they thought that was a great idea. And that very day, they picked a president, and they picked a name. They thought, well, we're near Washington. We'll call it the Washingtonians. So not only were they successful, they were majorly successful. In 3 years, they had over 300,000 members. And I think Joe was telling me the other night that that they were dues-paying members. That must have been great. Imagine 300,000 people paying dues as they walked in the door. And they met in different places. And they also met in pubs. They did. But they got involved they thought, oh, God, we are so successful. So let's get involved in, you know, slavery, like abolishing slavery. Let's do that. Let's get involved in helping really drug addicts. Let's help them. And they got involved in that. Then they branched out into sectarian religion. Let's find out how they're doing in religion and let's give them advice, you know, like really what kind of religion they should be in. And they got involved in everything. At the end of, I don't think it was 10 years, there wasn't one member left in the Washingtonians. Is that amazing? So what did they learn? That, you know, not sticking to the primary purpose, they absolved. So when Bill got that information, started immediately on getting the traditions together. New, because he did not want, certainly did not want a repeat of what happened. And are we incredibly lucky, I mean, to belong to a program that has traditions that actually protect us, each one of us, each group is protected by our traditions. Obviously, the traditions work at the Atlantic Group, or you wouldn't all be here. I'd like to say something else about the about how, you know, what I find amazing is that they became so thoroughly extinct that some 50 years later, I mean, Bill didn't know about them. I mean, no one knew. No one really knew the story of the Washingtonians. And that was a major, major lesson for us. It was. And there I give you the sixth tradition. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Bonnie.
Hi, I'm Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Twenty years ago today, I got sober. So, I'm a little overwhelmed this evening, so please forgive me. I have some real special people here tonight. A lot of the newcomers, so if you're new, welcome. but I have some really special people here, and not to embarrass them, but almost 9 years ago I got married, and my very best friend from sixth grade had two little girls, and I asked them to be my flower girls, and they're 16 and 18, and tonight they chose to come here to hear me speak. So welcome. And my very best friend, also Pen Pen, is here tonight, who 2 days ago had 20 years, and I said I would make a shout out for her. Okay, here it goes. Hang on, girls. Oh, your husband's going to be real thrilled. Okay. 20 years ago, I came in. I crawled in. I knew I, January 1st, 1988, I knew that I had a problem. I was living with a, and I'll talk very, very briefly about this. I was living with a Colombian drug dealer, so you could figure out what I was doing. I was drinking a liter of Absolut, and I was eating Valium like Pez candy. And I woke up, and I realized that that everybody else had stopped, and I was locked in the bathroom, and I couldn't. And I was scared out of my brain. I was scared. Because I knew that I had a problem. And before then, everybody was telling me with the finger pointing, you know, you have a problem, you have a problem. I think there's something that you need to do. And, you're always grateful when people point out things to you, aren't you? I know I was. I was just thrilled, you know, with a chip on my shoulder. So I knew the gig was up. And from January 1st, 1988, to June 24th, 1988, that was my hell. I had a problem, and I knew it. And I didn't have any answer. I had no solution, and I was scared. That's a frightening place to be. A couple of friends, I had been working at a restaurant, which obviously at that point I was unemployable because, you know, who could work? So I was living off of, I think his name was Tomas, I really don't know, the Colombian drug dealers. I really, honest to this day, on my father's grave, my brother's grave, all the graves, I have no idea what his name was, but whatever. And I couldn't work, I was unemployable, and I remember back in the day when I was working at this restaurant, them all telling me they had a problem, you had a problem, and maybe you should go to NA, something, and so, you know, I was really happy about that solution, and finally, I realized that I had a problem and I had to do something. And so I, by God's grace, there was a detox. I went to a detox. And I'm going to go back and forth, so please kind of be with me here. I remember calling my parents and saying to my parents, I need to go to a detox and I need $2,500. Now, you have to understand, this was always my relationship. It was just, you know, this was the bank of Mickey and Phil. I you know, it was constantly. So I called them up, and they were going on a cruise, which is a theme in my family. They started going on a cruise at when I was three. They went on a cruise, and they didn't take me. And recently, I was sitting shiva for my brother and mother, and there was loads of photographs on the mirror, and one of the photographs was of Mickey and Frank and Phil and Bernice on that cruise. Now, I don't know if a lot of people have their first resentment in black and white, but I do. And people who came to the shiver actually said, I pointed it out to them, and they were like, oh, my God, that's your first resentment when you were three. You had a resentment. So I got over that. But anyway, so here we are, and it's 88, June of 88, and they're going on a cruise, and my father says, look, we're going on a cruise this afternoon, but if you need some money, call our friend Adele. I had no idea who Adele was. Adele was a neighbor down the hall. I did not know her, but as a good alcoholic, I called her up, and I said, hi, I need $2,500. And you know what? God had a plan. Her son was in the rooms. And she said, no problem. I will meet you at the hospital. I'm not giving you a check. There's lots of those in my story. So Tomas drove me there. She wasn't very friendly to him. I don't know why. And so my journey began. I went into, I remember the first day. It's ironic, the things that I do remember and the fact that it is, now I came in at 27, so I'm 47 now. Look good, I know. But you could clap again, it's okay. No. I crawled in there, and I don't remember what I ate for breakfast, but I could tell you that day vividly. I remember coming in there and being in a locked ward, very flippant, very, you know, I had it going on. And when they closed the door, I was thinking, when I looked out the window, like, how did I get here? How did a nice Jewish girl from Forest Hills get into a locked ward? And it was a hot, hot summer day, you know, and I'm sure people were at the beach and, you know, normal people, like, what was I doing here? And you know, like, my parents sent me to private school and camp and Europe, and they bought me a co-op, and I don't know, and like, how did I get here? I had no clue. I really had no clue. And what they kept telling me there is that you need to make meetings, and they gave me this book, and I remember I wanted to be a movie star, so I remember the rehab that I needed to go to was out in Minnesota, and, you know, I wanted to go to that rehab, and, you know, I was just kind of like, I had no idea. And finally, I got out of there after 5 days, and this rehab in Minnesota couldn't take me, and I had to go back into the apartment with the dealer, and there's a lot of by graces of God. The first grace of God was, I'll never forget him saying, Mamita, why don't you sit down on the living room and we'll watch TV? And I said, you know what, I think I'm going to make a meeting. I don't know where that came from. I think I'm going to make a meeting. I don't know where that came from, but I believe it's God's grace. And one foot in front of the other. And then the rehab opened up, and I could go there, and he got picked up on 14th Street, and yada, yada, yada. And there I was. And for 9 months, I was in Minnesota, and then I do remember they did give me a big book, and they did give me a 12 and 12, and that's great, because they gave it to me, but I have no idea what I did with it. I think I might have read it. I know we signed all the books, you know, from the rehab girls, but other than that, I really don't know what I did. I came out, and I stayed in Minnesota for a while, and then I came back. And I'll never forget, because when I came back, I met a friend, and the friend is here tonight, and I am overwhelmed that she and I have been on this path for so long. And I'll never forget, because the first day she said, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee? And I was just blown away, like, oh, my God, she asked me for coffee, you know? And we've been on the fellowship and, you know, on the path. And, you know, that's a gift. That's a real gift. This one in the front row, everyone knows, Ava, has been on the path. And I got lucky. Lucky. I did some work. I started to show up. I started to show up for myself. And for the first 5 years, I absolutely showed up. But that's all I did. I put down the drink. I put down the drugs, and I showed up, and I did service, but I didn't do any big book work, and I got to tell you, I was pretty insane. You know, I came in on the first step. I knew I was powerless, and I knew if I picked up, I was going to die. I got that. And I did not think I was going to reach the age of 30, nor did I want to. Because my best plans didn't work. And if I had a feeling, I numbed it out. And we all know how to do that. I had no clue how to get into any solution. And I was miserable. And I thought, and this is my story, the therapist would help. And I knew, oh, right, the boyfriend. Oh, right, that's going to cure it. And so, you know, I went to certain meetings where you'd find the boyfriend. And I found one. And, you know... A real recipe for disaster. A real recipe for disaster. And I was miserable. It says it in the big book, restless, irritable, and discontented. So I. 5.5 years. And finally, I was like, wow, this is really a drag. Now what do? I want to blow my brains out. That's pretty intense. And so I remember being at a gym that I couldn't afford, but that was the place to be. And I remember looking through a meeting book, and I remember, like, at least I had that tool. Like, I had the meeting book with me. And I remember seeing a meeting and thinking, oh, great, that meeting is right near the R train, and I live in Queens. I'm a Queens girl. I still live there. And I thought, oh, I can get directly home from there, so it'll work. You know, cafeteria style, like whatever it works, you know, take what I can and just keep taking. So, I went to this meeting and, I met a bunch of people, and I remember looking at this one woman. Oh, she was really coiffed and she was very beautiful and her nails were done. And I thought, oh, this will be my sponsor. So I walked over to her and I said, would you be my sponsor? And she said, oh, I haven't done the work, but this other woman has, and, you know, why don't you, you know. And so I walked over to her and I looked her up and down, as, you know, I always took up other people's inventory. And I said, I don't have a sponsor. She goes, well, this is my phone number. Why don't you call me? And I thought to myself, oh, my God, call you, you know, Friday night. Oh, my God, the woman must have no life. You know, I mean, you know, it's Friday night, it's date night. So I called her and, you know, proceeded to talk about myself as I usually did. And she said, listen, you're an actress, right? I said, yeah. She said, look, so you can read. I said, oh, yeah. And so she said, she goes, why don't you read the first 163 pages of the big book? I'm going to Florida for the weekend and we'll discuss it afterwards. I said, okay. So I remember opening the book that weekend and, you know, God, was this boring, but, you know, whatever. And when she came back, I called her up and I proceeded to talk about myself. And she said, listen, did you read it? And I said, well, it was boring. And she kind of said, listen, when you're done reading it, call me. Wow. That was the first time that somebody didn't, like, you know, I couldn't manipulate, I couldn't, nothing. And I knew that I was dying. I knew it, and I had no other answers. So it talks about in the big book, spiritual tools laid at our feet will go on blotting to the bitter end, a miserable life. Wow, some choice. What's it gonna be? All right, I'll call her, I'll do whatever, I'll make these meetings. And I did. Another shout out to two very favorite people, Jody and Al, thank you for coming. I made some very good friends there that are still in my life. And I'm very grateful. Something happened. You talk about a spiritual experience, personality change. Those girls, the Penny, the Ava, the Amy, started to notice something, you know, because they were getting a little tired of my act, and they noticed something. It says it in the big book that other people will notice it before you will. My mother was deliriously happy. She didn't know what this woman was doing, but she was like, ooh, you know. And things started to change, but not enough. I had the book, but I had it in my head, and I didn't have it in my heart, and this is the language of the heart. And I had met somebody a long time ago when the Midtown was here, and this group used to be called Midtown downstairs, and I always admired her, and I always looked up to her, and I knew she was coming to this group, and I was so scared to ask her to be my sponsor, I think she finally said to me, are you asking me to be your sponsor? And I was like, yeah. You know, and I'm so grateful for your example. Myra's been my sponsor for the last 11 years of my sobriety. It's a journey. And, you know, a lot of things I don't take for granted anymore. Recently, not to delve into it, but I've had a tragic loss in my life, and my brother passed away, and he did pass away from this disease. I spoke to his doctor on Monday, his regular doctor, his primary doctor, who turns out to be a doctor of addiction and la-la-la, you know, and alcoholism. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's good. I said, did you know that Frankie drank? And he went, yeah. And I told him that if he had one more, just one more, his heart couldn't take it. And he drank. And that's the way it goes. And he had congestive heart failure due to drinking. And the last few years of his life, I'm sure, were not pleasant. And so when he died in his van, and they didn't find him for 8 days, that was sad. And that's stuff that I live with. I learning and understanding that you gotta want it. You gotta want this program. You know, it's taken me, and I have to tell you that I am grateful for every minute of my sobriety. I'm grateful for every day. I am grateful because it took that amount of strength and the fellowship and the love to carry me through the last 6 weeks and to carry me through since April 14th when I found out he passed. My heart's broken. Won't be fixed. But this too shall pass. Won't forget, but it'll pass. And then my mother passed, and it was a double burial. I gotta tell you, people from this home group and people that showed up, 30 people on a horrible, rainy, disgusting day coming in. Over 100 people sit and shiver with me and my husband. Over 70 condolence cards. You know, it helped. It helped. And I know for me, you gotta want it. You know, how did I get 20 years? A day at a time. A day at a time. I am grateful that on Tuesday nights I'm usually up in the balcony with a sponsee and we're just going through the book, or, you know, and recently it came alive, especially Bill's story. I was like, wow, you know, because I can't stop thinking about my brother. I mean, that's the truth. That's where my head's at right now. And it has not been easy, you know, and I didn't want to come here on Tuesday nights. You know, I wanted to stay in bed and I wanted to cry. But I showed up. And I think that's what it's going to say on my tombstone. She shows up. There's a lot of other things that's gone on in my life. You know, I got married over 9 years ago. I pursue a career of the dreams that I want to pursue. I do a lot of different things, you know, sobriety is first, because, you know, when I had to go out to California and cremate my brother, the first thing Vince and I did is that we made a meeting out in Santa Monica, you know, and thank God for GPS, so we call it Ava, but, you know, the little, you know, recalculation. And, you know, one of the first things I remember when this happened is that I was graced enough that I called Myra up and I told her, and we were crying, and then she said, you know what, Bon? You were clean with him. Now, clean means that I made a 9-step amends. Now, I have 5 minutes left. I didn't go through the steps, but, you know, on my 4th step, my mother was all over the place. I mean, just absolutely all over the place. I resented her. And I blamed her for my alcoholism. And by doing a 4th step and by taking a 5th step and seeing defects of character in 6 and 7, I realized she didn't cause anything. She was doing the best that she possibly could. And so when I made a 9-step amends to her, and I went to my father's grave and I made a 9-step amends to my father's grave, I said that I would be a daughter. I said that I would be a sister. I said that I would be a niece. And I did that. And when my mother got sick for the last 7 years of her life, I got the opportunity and the grace to show up with a little bit of dignity to help her out. And let me tell you, it wasn't easy. If anyone, oh, it's a gift. I don't know about that, and I don't know how much a gift. All right, I'll write that out later. But I didn't do it alone. This is a WE program. I didn't get to do this alone, you know. And so I was with her the last 48 hours of her life. I was right there. I'll never forget when they gave her the first shot of morphine. I was like, Mom, this is the good stuff. Hang on, you know. Only a sickie like me, you know. But I was there. And once again, I showed up. And, you know, it's still not easy stuff. Now there's a will. And called up Myra, you know, walk through the third step. Okay. You know, not easy stuff. Who wants to do this? I want to be a little girl being taken care of. But you know what? Time to grow up. And that's what this program has taught, you know, has given me the opportunity. In 20 years, I've grown up a little bit, you know, a little bit. And I get to carry the message to others. And I'm grateful that people actually, you know, call me. Sponsor or not a sponsor, sponsee or not a sponsee, friends or not friends, you know, and it's a WE program. I'm lucky. We're lucky. Not 2,000 people in this room tonight. Not 8 million. I don't know, 300-400. Trust me, a lot more out there dying. So, if you're new, hang on, get somebody, please get somebody, sweetie, get somebody. You know, in this group, it's like piranhas. You won't leave the room before you get a sponsor. I'm telling you right now. You'd be lucky if you get out the door alive. And I want to thank, this is my home group, and I just want to thank everybody for showing up. Thank you.